This is 4:55 on Friday, October 4th. All right. Good morning. Try that again. Good morning. So it's Friday, and a large fraction of the class decided not to be here. I don't know what to think about that. All right. Well, anyway, last time we wrapped up talking about DHCP, there was this slide that had Wireshark output, and I said, well, that doesn't look very realistic as far as Wireshark output goes. So let's actually look at some Wireshark output. So Wireshark is a program that can sniff, the technical term, traffic on a network. And you can install it on pretty much any kind of system, Unix-y, Windows-y. You go to the Wireshark.org homepage, and you'll find the download for Windows. You can typically install it from your Linux-y package manager, whatever it is, be already packaged there. With Windows, you typically also have to install something called the PCAP library separately. This is a sort of general purpose library that interfaces the Wireshark program and other similar programs to the actual networking interface. And so what I did this morning, I hope this is not still running. No, it's not still running. What I did this morning was, with the computer on the wireless WSU wireless network, I did some things that would cause DHC operations to occur and captured the relevant packets, and now we can explore them at our leisure to see what happens. So I began with the command. Do I have the command window here? Actually began with the command ipconfig/release, which is a command in Windows that causes DHCP to have a release interaction with the DHCP server, which gives up the network address that it already has. And I wanted to do that so that I could see the full interaction of the acquire process. So we begin with a release, and then in Windows you say ipconfig renew, and that will cause a DHCP interaction to occur, and we can then explore it in the Wireshark trace. So here's the list of packets up here at the top that have been captured, and I've got a filter established that says only show me the ones related to DHCP, which happens on UDP ports 67 and 68. And so saying UDP port 67 just gets me things related to DHCP. And the first thing that happens, and you can't really see it, let me move this down here so you can really see the first one. The first thing of interest with DHCP is this DHCP release of the packet number 28. You can see that at the time that I did the release, I knew my IP address and I knew who the DHCP server was, and so I just sent this message. So let's look into what's inside that message. And while we do this, we'll explore not only the DHCP stuff, but we can also explore other things. So Wireshark has built into it decoders for all the different protocols that you're likely to encounter, and many more as well. And what it does is, remember, a packet on the network is going to consist of a link layer header, a network layer header, a transport layer header, and finally get down to the application protocol, which in this case is DHCP, but Wireshark knows about what's inside DHCP as well, so it can tell us what's happening at the DHCP level. So our link layer here, I don't quite know what this frame thing does. Oh, this is sort of a pseudo header. This is just something that Wireshark itself makes up to help it display things like time and so forth. So that's not too relevant. So our link layer here is Ethernet, and it we'll talk about link layer in the next chapter, but you see that even at the link layer we have a destination and a source, but the addresses don't look like IP addresses, and that's going to be important. That's not where we are right now. Okay. So you can close that up, and let's close this one up. This one up. Let's look inside the Internet protocol. So this is the network layer header, and Wireshark knows where the source field is and where the destination field is. It knows that this is IP version 4, and that there's a 20 byte network layer header. There's some flags there in the header that we don't use, so they're all zeros. It's 328 bytes. Remember what the role of the identification field is, the ID field for fragmentation. Not going to be an issue here. Flags field, we don't care about. It's not fragmented. Time to live, 128. Wow. That's a lot. I think 64 is sort of much more common. The problem with time to live, remember, is that time to live gets decremented every time the packet passes through a router. So if this packet gets launched into the internet and sort of goes off into the wild, it will travel around quite a while before it gets killed off by time to live. And it's a UDP protocol. There's a header checksum. And for some reason it shows, this is the detailed version that shows the source and destination. And somewhere in here there should be, the port number is going to be in the UDP header. So let's move to the UDP header. Okay. So the source port is 68. And Wireshark, again, knows a lot about a lot of standard port numbers. So it says that this is the client port number for the BootP protocol. So DHCP is, in fact, a successor to an earlier protocol that was called BootP. And DHCP uses the same ports that BootP did. So this is BootP client, BootP server. The way you distinguish between whether you're talking DHCP and BootP is later down in the data of the protocol itself. Okay? And there's a checksum there. What does checksum look like? What a funny way to report that. You would think that it would be necessary that if good checksum were true, bad checksum would be false, and you wouldn't have to tell us both. But maybe there's a reason for it. I don't know. Close that up. All right. Well, when I highlight things, then you can't read them, so I won't do that. Do it with my finger. So, this is the Bootstrap protocol, BootP, and this is a request message. We're running on an Ethernet. It just tells us some things about the situation. And then there's a transaction ID. Remember, the transaction ID for DHCP is to associate a client request with a response from the server, because you may not be able to tell otherwise what it is. So it's kind of a randomish looking number. And then come some flags. Scroll this down. The flags here fields are interpreted by Wireshark to say this is a unicast message. Okay. The client IP address, which I said we know because this is a release. The rest of the stuff is sort of not filled in, but here, and eventually you see this line, which says, "This is DHCP, and it's a DHCP release message, and that we know who our server is, and so on and so forth." Okay, so Wireshark interprets sort of everything in the packet that it can to let us inspect it. And then down below here, if you're really masochistic, you can actually see in hex the bytes of the message. And occasionally this is useful, but those are, like I said, painful situations where you have to look at the hex of the message. Sort of look like looking at core dumps in the old days. So we don't want to do that. All right, so that was the release message. And then comes the point where I said ipconfig renew. Similar stuff in the headers, but now notice we don't know our own IP address. So the source address here is 0. It says, I don't know my IP address, and I don't know your IP address, so I have to use the sort of global broadcast address to do that. And I also use the Ethernet broadcast address to do a broadcast at the link layer as well as at the Internet layer. Now, one thing that is of interest here is that once upon a time, a destination like address like this that says broadcast would have been interpreted as broadcast to the Internet. That stopped working about 25 years ago. The Internet got too big. And so once upon a time, it was the case that routers were configured to take addresses like this and send those messages out on all their interfaces. These days, I think it had better be the case that routers are configured by default not to do that. That this is interpreted as a link local broadcast address, even though it looks like broadcast to everybody in the world. All right. Again, it's user UDP. Again, it's boot P type. Again, it's saying, I don't know much about anything here. My link layer address is such and so. And that's that. Okay. And so the type here is DHCP discover. And what does it say? It says I've got a certain link layer address again. And again, and then it says, now this is interesting, I did an ipconfig release on the machine, but apparently the machine remembered the address that it had before and would like to have it back again. The server is free to say, no, you can't have that. Remembers its host name, which is Kona. And it says something about what kind of machine it is in case that I end up asking for different things. But let's see what I can ask for. Look at all the things that I'm asking the DHCP server to provide me. Of course I want to know my IP address. That's sort of a given. But I also want to know my subnet mask, my domain name, my default router, my DNS server, a whole bunch of stuff related to running Windows networking. I don't know what perform router discover is. If there's a static route that I'm supposed to be using, a static route is a route that says to go to this specific network, I should go to a particular router, as opposed to just using my default router. So I'm asking if that's available. Says that I'm able to handle classic static routes and also in Microsoft format, whatever that might mean. I don't know. We could look it up. And that's that. Okay, so that's my request out to the network. And in response, the server comes back and says, now one thing to notice here, is that the response that comes back here appears to come from a host that's on the same network as this address that I'm requesting. That even though the actual server is on a different network. Why is that? Because at this stage, remember, we don't have an IP address. We can't route anything. We have to do things only on link layer stuff. Right? So no routing. So that's why, even though it has an IP address here, the IP address is not the real address of the server. It's the address of what's called a relay server that will pass messages back and forth between the current link layer that we're on and a server that's somewhere else. So we'll see how that goes in here in a second. So this is the response. Now let's slide up here. Okay, Bootstrap. And we can see that here. The relay agent is the one that has this .31.253 address. It's not really the server. The actual server is not told to us here. It's told to us down in the options. Okay, so what was it able to tell us? It was able to tell us its own IP address, the DHCP server. It was able to tell us how long we were going to be allowed to use this address, which was 1 hour, which is sort of different from the 1 hour and whatever it was that we discovered last time when we looked at police time. Told us the subnet mask. Told us the default router address. It told us two domain name servers. It told us some things about NetBIOS, and that was all it was able to. So we asked it for a bunch of stuff, and it only answered a subset of the questions, okay? Because those are the ones that are relevant on this network. If the client had received those others, then it would have been able to do some additional things. So then the client turns around and says, okay, I got all that stuff. And please actually give it to me now. So the offer is just a proposal. The client has to turn around and request what it wants out of that offer. And still requests other things, and eventually then the server comes back and says, okay, here we go. So that's the dance that we go through just to get an IP address. And I wanted to show that in detail just so that you get a flavor of what mostly what Wireshark can do. Let's look at some other things in Wireshark. I'm going to clear that filter, so now we see all of the traffic that was captured. And I just sort of started at a random point, so you never know what you're going to see at the beginning. But we can see a HTTP conversation here that ended. See the fin and the ack. We could see an attempt to connect to my machine. This one here, packet 8. It's a little hard to see, but somebody tried to make a TCP connection to my machine on port 5184, and my machine said, "Go away." That's the reset here. Don't bother me there. I'm not going to talk to you. Then there's a lot of NetBIOS stuff, just Microsoft, old Microsofty stuff. Windows 3.1 and Windows 95 that still persists in the world. There's my DHCP release. Here's some multicast stuff using ICMP version 6 from IP version 6. So the IP version 6 world is starting to show up on the real networks. What else? I don't know what LLMNR is as a port. Somebody want to look that up? Looks like it's using IP version 6 for that, but I don't know what it's all about. So anyway, you can install Wireshark and watch what's going on in the network around you. There are certainly some environments where running Wireshark would be considered against policy, maybe even at WSU. If you run it, you should be using it to look for passwords and then using them or something. That would be a very bad thing, like bye-bye from the university. U.S. Penn, U.S. Penitentiary, yeah, if things get too bad. So, but on the other hand, as somebody who's operating and running a network, you sometimes have to use these tools in order to figure out what's happening. Typical thing would be clients making a DHCP request, but for some reason not ever getting a IP address. What's going on? Is it because the client's request message is not reaching the server because the relay is misconfigured? Is it because for some reason the client is not happy with the responses that it's coming back and it's throwing them away? Once upon a time when I was at Xerox, there's another service called YP, Yellow Pages, or Network Information Service, and we had a horrible time with machines that could not get their configurations from this NIS service, and it was with a tool like this that we were able to figure out what was going on. The problem was that with NIS, the rule is that you only accept your configuration from somebody on the same link layer network. But it works at the IP layer. But you're only willing to accept it on somebody on the same subnet is would be the way to characterize it. So you're only willing to accept that. Anything else is considered invalid. Routers are supposed to be configured so that your request messages for the information don't leave the same subnet. And so you always get the only answers you'll ever get come back from the same subnet. Well, there were two bugs here, and the client requests were being leaked to another subnet, which was wrong, not supposed to happen. The server on the other network was so much faster than the server on the local network that the server on the other network responded first. Okay? The client said, I'm not supposed to listen to his answer. So it stopped listening for all answers. And so then the answer would come from the local server and the client would already have gone on and be off trying again. Well, what it would do would say, I got the answer for the wrong guy, so I better try again, right? Better ask the question again. So he'd ask the question again, and the same thing would happen again. And so he never listened to the good answers he was getting. He always listened to the bad answers. And so, you know, it didn't work. And how do you find it? Something like that. Only by actually seeing the pattern of the traffic. I don't know sort of any other way to do that. So that's Wireshark. Fun tool. And many, many more options and configurations and it can. Let me show you one other thing if I've got anything useful here to do on. I need a HTTP connection here. I mostly don't have it because I didn't do any. Oh. While we're at it, here's an ARP conversation. Remember, we haven't talked about ARP yet. So we'll save that for another day. ARP comes later once we talk about... I guess I don't have any real... there's one. Here's a TCP conversation that lasts for a while. When I pick a TCP conversation, I can say analyze and say follow TCP stream. And it will tell me everything that happened in that stream. Well, this one wasn't very interesting. It did a get, but got no response. Other things, there's statistics. Where's the one? IOGraphs. Tell you how much traffic is going on your network over a period of time. And it can also look at... Okay, remember those diagrams that we've built of acts and things? Well, it can actually build you diagrams that look like that. They don't offset, they don't offset the send and receive times because it's only from a single perspective. But you can see the SYN ACK, the ACK, and then here comes the actual traffic. So you can make them things like that. So, great tool. Any questions? Go play. That's go play with it. That's my advice. All right. So, we need to move on. So we talked about how a host gets its host address and finds out what subnet it's on. How does the DHCP server find out what information it's supposed to supply to the host. Well, that has to be configured, typically. It's configured by the network administrator based on things that the network administrator learns from the upstream internet provider. So the way it typically goes is that a service provider talks to its service provider and says, give me a bunch of addresses. And hopefully they come in fairly good sized chunks, you know, a few hundred or a thousand at a time. And so the ISP will be allocated a block, and this diagram is wrong. That shouldn't be there. It's slash 20, right? So the ISP's block is a slash 20 subnet, and that means that the ISP is allowed to allocate all of the addresses in there, but rather than allocate them one by one to hosts and all of its customers, what it does is it hands out a subset of the addresses to each customer, and it does that by giving them different prefixes for their own networks that extends what's already been given to the ISP. So one of the customers gets the 000 space, one gets the 001 space, and so on. All right? So by taking its slash 20 address space and carving it up into slash 23 spaces, it gets the ability to support seven organizations with, what, 512 host addresses each, right? Because 23 bits here from 32 leaves 9 for the host addresses. So 512 minus the two reserved ones, 510. All right. So now, when the internet service provider talks to its upstream provider of network services, it can say, give me all the stuff that comes on the slash 20 address. Remember we talked about last time how in routing it uses longest prefix matching? So when I've got all of these addresses and they're all coming to the same place, I might as well aggregate them all into a single address that I advertise upstream. It says give me all the traffic for any of those networks, and I just have to have one routing table entry to do that. And somebody else uses a different one. Now, what happens if one of these organizations decides it no longer wants to have fly-by-night ISP as its provider, but it wants to keep its addresses? Well, in that case, such an organization will move to this other provider, and fly-by-night ISP continues to say that it takes all the traffic for the slash 20 space, but ISPs or us says, I'll take that hole out of there, the one that starts with 18.0 with a slash 23. So you see how that works? This one actually is inside this one, but because it's longer, it overrides it. So the traffic will come this way for this network and that way for the rest of them. Are we okay with that? Longest prefix matching. Okay, so where does the ISP get its addresses? Well, the lower level ISPs get them from their upper level providers, but the sort of highest level providers get them from an organization called the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. And it allocates addresses to different organizations, and manages DNS and all kinds of other things at certain levels. And then there are other DNS providers that do these services in other top-level domains. So there is a central authority for all of this. I read in the paper not too many days ago that Brazil was so upset with the United States about the snooping stuff that's been going on in the NSA that they were wanting to establish a whole new infrastructure for doing this kind of stuff, DNSs and address allocations. What would be the consequence of that? Yeah. You certainly could run into conflicts where it became unclear which direction traffic should go, and what would people do to fix that? They'd probably start to say, you can't connect to me, right? Because you have conflicting addresses. And what does that do? It destroys the whole model of having a worldwide resource that allows anybody to talk to anybody else, to very close first approximation. Right? So that would not be a good thing, but when you make people angry, you can cause all kinds of mischief. All right. Another issue that crops up is, let me go back to here. Okay, ICANN has more or less handed out all the available IPv4 addresses that there are. And it may have a few in some areas, but not many, and certainly not enough to accommodate billions of new people coming onto the internet. So, and furthermore, this has been true for the last at least 5 and probably 10 years. So how have we survived? Well, the key to our survival over the last decade or so has been this technique called network address translation. And basically what NAT does is it allows one IP address, one public IP address, to serve many hosts on a private network. And so there are spaces within the IPv4 address range that are called unroutable addresses. And they are the class A 10 network. So if you have addresses that start with 10 dot something, you're not allowed to actually put them out onto the public internet. You can keep them private to your organization. You can use them entirely as you like. Therefore, there could be many organizations that use the Class A 10 network. Similarly, there are Class B and Class C network ranges that are also called private address space, and they're not allowed to go on the internet. And so what you do is you define your network using these private addresses, and then you attach it to the public internet using a router that translates these addresses to a single public IP address. And we'll look at how that works. Okay, so internally here we use the 10 dot addresses. Outside, anything that we send from in here has to be translated to use this as its IP address. And the trick is that we can play with the port numbers to make this work. So let's see how that works. I think we talked about all of the motivation. Here's a motivation. One of the nice things about NAT is that you can change your public IP address without having to reconfigure all of your local machines, which is a good thing. When I was at Xerox, we contemplated, Xerox had one of those Class A addresses, right? It was 13 dot something. So we had the 24 million addresses and no use for them. Icon was running out of address space and would have liked to get some back and might have paid us for them. But we ultimately decided that, you know, given the amount they were willing possibly to pay, that the pain of readdressing all of our machines was larger than that number. And partly that was because we were living in the days before DHCP, so all of the machines were statically configured to first approximation. So every machine would have had to be specifically visited to have its IP address changed. And that was just too painful. So as far as I know, Xerox still has the 13 address space, 13 dot whatever address space, and never carved it up. But maybe, I don't know. Whereas if we had lived with NATing, that wouldn't have been an issue. Now on the WSU campus, we have a mixture of things. Some networks are publicly addressable networks, and other networks are using these private addresses and NATing. Okay, so how does it work? How does it work? When a local machine with, say, the 10 dot something address is sending out to the public internet, you take the source IP address in the datagram, you replace it with the single public address, and you pick a new port number for that packet, and you remember that port number. Okay? Because what's going to happen is that sometime later, somebody on the outside is going to send something back trying to go to that port number. The NAT box doesn't really want to handle it, wants to pass it on to the original source. So you remember it, and when the incoming traffic arrives, you look up the port number that's the remember part. And then when a new coming datagram comes in, you're looking at the public IP address of the box, you're looking at the port number that the box assigned, and so it could look in its table and say, who does that really go to? Particular actual on the local network source and port number. Picture of this. So we send something to a destination outside using port 3345. The NAT box sends it to the same destination port and address, but switches the port number to 5001 and remembers that is really supposed to go to this guy. Sometime later, something comes back that says that it's going to go to this address, but it gets translated and goes there instead, right? So, simple idea. Since there are 16-bit port numbers, we can do 64K simultaneous connections, only limited by the table space. But, and like I said, this has really been the salvation of IPv4 for the last 10 years. Couldn't have survived without it. However, NAT is controversial because notice what it means. This is a router, right? Routers, as we've learned everywhere up to now, are not supposed to monkey with things at the transport layer. Where are the port numbers? They're at the transport layer. So network purists say this is not good, right? Because routers are now doing things at the transport layer, that, and routers shouldn't do that. Another thing that is an issue here is that it really does break universal connectivity. Now, that is not always a bad thing, actually. But notice that if a host here has not initiated a conversation outside, there's nothing in the table. And so somebody outside who wants to contact one of these hosts can't do it. There are workarounds for this. There are things called DMZ configuration. There's something called explicit port forwarding that you can typically configure in these NAT boxes to ensure that a few hosts back here are in fact reachable on specific ports. Okay? But it will have to be on specific ports. It can't be generally that's true. But as I say, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because doing that really insulates these hosts from a lot of otherwise garbagey traffic that they would have to deal with that gets rejected at this layer. So mixed bag there. So, you know, the network purists say that instead we should just all be using IPv6, but we're not all using IPv6, and if we said we can't use NAT anymore starting tomorrow, instead to use IPv6, the world would stop working. You know, it'd sort of be like government shutdowns and all that stuff. Only much worse. Much worse. Oh, so this is the traversal problem, right? That the client shows up, wants to talk to somebody over there, can't get there, so explicit forwarding can be done. Another thing that that you sometimes see these days on your home routers is something called universal plug and play, and that's a way for an application running on a machine back here to negotiate port forwarding dynamically. So you don't necessarily have to configure it as the administrator of the box. It can be established by a program running back here. Now, again, this is pretty controversial, and when I remember to do it, I always turn it off on my boxes. Because what does it mean? It means that a rogue program back here can do evil things to your configuration here. And so, although I've, thank goodness, mostly managed to avoid installing rogue programs on my home network, it has happened, and I don't want to count on that. So I don't see any big reason to turn it on, but then I'm not a gamer, right? So gaming folks like to do this. Voice over IP folks with sort of boxes, you know, that you buy at Best Buy for doing phone calls, they often like to have universal plug and play turned on here because it makes their job easier. So your choice when you set that up. Okay, so this is an explicit description of an example of this, how this works. So you could look at that. Another possibility, I'll just finish this up, is that you always actually have a outgoing connection established to somewhere, and the somewhere becomes the point of contact for other people wanting to reach you. That's called relaying. Okay, so then we can stop. And next time, talk about ICMP and IP version 6. and then move on to routing algorithms. So I strongly encourage you to read the section on routing algorithms before next time. It will be very helpful. One moment.